Good evening, everyone. I am Adrienne Ingram, and I'm delighted to welcome you who have come out in the rain, and even though it stopped raining now, to hear our speaker, James Oak. He will help us reflect on the sesquicentennial of the Emancipation Proclamation. Last month, Professor Oakes was awarded the 2013 Lincoln Prize for his most recent book, Freedom National, The Destruction of Slavery in the United States, 1861 to 1865. The New York Society Library, however, invited James Oakes to speak to us before he won the prize. So while we might not award cash prizes and bronze busts, as do Gettysburg College and the Gilda Lehrman Institute for American History, we sure do know how to pick fine scholars. Our speaker is a native of New York City, educated at Baruch College, and he returned here to teach at CUNY Graduate Center after studying on the West Coast at UC Berkeley and teaching in the Midwest at Northwestern and at Princeton. He's written three books and hundreds of articles. And I'd like to share with you some words written by James Oakes that reveal what a special scholar he is. I've always taken a certain stubborn pride in resisting popular trends. But if I'm not advocating trendiness, neither do I have any desire to dig in my heels and cling to the scholarship of the past, especially my own. Over the years, I've changed my mind about many things. I even enjoy the experience of realizing that something I once believed to be true no longer seems to be so. This process of self-revision began years ago, shortly after my first book was published. I try not to be overly committed to anything I've put into print. Print captures my thinking at the moment of publication. Sometimes all it takes is evidence, new or newly persuasive evidence, to get me to change my mind. At other times, I become aware of dubious premises I had unconsciously assumed and so back away. And there's always something new to learn. The more documents I read, the more nuances I'm likely to notice in the next one I read. It's like learning a language I didn't know existed. It's hard to figure it out, but it's also fun, serious but joyful. It's why I love what I do, because every day the past seems just a little bit different to me than it seemed the day before. Let's give a warm welcome to James Oakes.
Thank you so much for that generous introduction, and I have to admit, it's a little bit embarrassing. I was born and raised in New York, and I live across town on the Upper West Side. I've passed this building a million times. This is the first time I've ever been in it. I don't know that to be ashamed of myself or to say that it was worth the wait. It's beautiful. It's really a beautiful building, and I thank you again for coming out tonight. The title of my talk is... Oh, sure. The title of my talk is The Emancipation Proclamation, Myths and, is that better? Myths and Realities. I think that you'll understand it by the time I finish, I hope. There was great excitement among the slaves on Charles Hayes's plantation, 16 miles from Louisville, when they heard the news that Abraham Lincoln had issued an Emancipation Proclamation a few days before. It was early January of 1863, and a number of Union men passing the Hayes plantation, quote, inquired of the slaves if their master had set them free. Fearing he would be arrested if he failed to let his slaves know of their freedom, Hayes appeared one morning as the slaves were eating their breakfast. In a nervous, uneasy manner, he made the announcement, quote, "Men and women, hear me. I'm about to tell you something I never expected to be obliged to tell you in all my life, and it is this. It becomes my duty to inform you, one and all, women, men, and children, belonging to me, you are free to go where you please." Hayes then cursed Lincoln, quote, "for taking all you Negroes away from me." A great jubilee commenced on the plantation, but old Massa got drunk and skulked off to his room while his slaves were, quote, "cheering Abraham Lincoln." "Bless the Lord," Aunt Bess exclaimed, "my children are all free." It's an interesting story in its own right, and it helps us appreciate one of the many ways the slaves were freed during the Civil War. But I want to make a different point about the story, and it is this. If you ever hear someone say that the Emancipation Proclamation didn't free a single slave, think of Charles Hayes cursing Abraham Lincoln back in January of 1863. But let's move ahead to March 29th, 1864, and listen to a different kind of speech, this one given by Senator Lyman Trumbull as he reported the 13th Amendment, the one abolishing slavery, out of his Judiciary Committee. Why do we need such an amendment, Trumbull asked. Because the Emancipation Proclamation was not enough, he answered. Trumbull cited the critics who claimed that at best Lincoln's proclamation had applied only to slaves who were actually physically freed during the war, like the slaves on Charles Hayes's plantation. Trumbull wasn't sure the critics were right, but he could not be sure they were wrong either. This was a serious problem because most slaves in the Confederate States were not, as Lincoln put it, practically freed during the war, and when the war ended, emancipation would stop. And what would happen? What of the slaves of the loyal masters in the loyal slave states? The Emancipation Proclamation didn't free them either, Trumbull pointed out. And even if Lincoln's proclamation had freed them, Trumbull went on, what was to stop the southern states from re-enslaving them after the war was over? Freedom was national, Republicans believed, whereas slavery was merely local. It was a state institution, and when the peace was restored, the power over slavery would revert to the states. For all these reasons and more, Trumbull argued, we must have a constitutional amendment abolishing slavery. Trumbull's speech lacks the human drama of Charles Hayes's announcement of emancipation to his slaves, but it suggests an equally important lesson. When you hear someone say that in affixing his signature to the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln freed all the slaves, quote, with the stroke of his pen, think of Senator Lyman Trumbull desperately imploring his colleagues to pass the 13th Amendment, because if they didn't, the war would end without slavery having been abolished in most of the South. We oversimplify the Emancipation Proclamation. It didn't free a single slave. It freed all the slaves. We shroud the document in myths. We conjure up myths about Abraham Lincoln to explain our myths about his proclamation. He was a reluctant emancipator. That's why he didn't free a single slave. He was the great emancipator who freed all the slaves. And all of this mythology was as popular back then as it is today. It was already in place, publicly debated, even before Lincoln issued the proclamation. We are blinded by these myths. We always have been. So much so that now, even now, 150 years later, we cannot answer the simplest but most important question, what did the Emancipation Proclamation actually do? The mythology of the proclamation has a lot to do with its timing. Lincoln issued it on January 1st, 1863, nearly 20 months after the war started, thereby raising the question, what took him so long? In the summer of 1862, when people first tried to answer that question, they usually resorted to idle speculations. They drew inferences based on ignorance of what Lincoln was up to. And it didn't take long for all of those speculations and inferences to harden into myth, or rather into two myths, one of them pro-Lincoln and the other anti-Lincoln. Horace Greeley may be taken as the spokesman for, if not the godfather of, the anti-Lincoln myth. Greeley was the opinionated editor of the New York Tribune, one of the most influential papers in the United States. In August of 1862, Greeley published a famous editorial called The Prayer of 20 Millions. The 20 million referred to the number of people living in the northern states, and what they were all praying for, according to Greeley, was emancipation. Greeley demanded that the president, quote, enforce the law, specifically the emancipation provisions of the Second Confiscation Act that Lincoln had signed 1 month earlier on July 17, 1862. Those provisions would not take full effect until the president issued a proclamation. Everyone assumed Lincoln would issue it shortly after he signed the bill, but he didn't, and after 3 or 4 weeks, Greeley was losing his patience. "Why the delay?" he asked, and in his answer, he concocted one of those enduring myths I mentioned earlier. "Lincoln was taking so long," Greeley wrote, "because in his heart of hearts, he didn't really want to free the slaves." From the start of the war, Lincoln had resisted every effort to undermine slavery. "Look at the record," Greeley urged. Lincoln came into office in March of 1861, vowing not to interfere with slavery in the states where it already existed. In September, he overturned the proclamation by General John C. Fremont that would have freed the slaves of all the rebels in Missouri. In May of 1862, Lincoln overturned another order, General David Hunter's edict abolishing slavery in Georgia, South Carolina, and Florida. A few months later, Lincoln nearly threw the national government into a crisis by threatening to veto the Second Confiscation Act, the very law that would free slaves as soon as Lincoln issued his proclamation. And now, a month later, the nation sits and waits for Lincoln to implement a statute he never liked to begin with. In Greeley's telling, Lincoln was a most reluctant emancipator. He took so long to issue the Emancipation Proclamation because he never wanted to issue it, and when he finally did issue it, Lincoln did so not for lofty moral reasons, not because slavery was wrong, but because the destruction of slavery had become what Lincoln called a military necessity. To this day, skeptics recite the same litany Greeley did, use the same reasoning, and come to the same conclusion. It took 20 months to issue the proclamation because Lincoln was reluctant to make emancipation a legitimate goal of the war, and finally did so only to deprive the rebels of their slaves in order to win the war. 1 month after Greeley published his Prayer of 20 Millions, Lincoln issued, on September 22, 1862, a preliminary Emancipation Proclamation announcing his intention to free the slaves 100 days later. This preliminary proclamation provoked a rash of commentary, including a remarkable essay in the Atlantic Monthly magazine written by none other than Ralph Waldo Emerson, the famed Transcendentalists. Emerson's essay can be read as a response to Horace Greeley's Prayer of 20 Millions, an alternative explanation for the timing of the president's proclamation, except that Emerson's explanation for the delay reflected glory rather than disgrace upon Lincoln. Where Greeley gave us the myth of the reluctant emancipator, Emerson gave us the myth of the great emancipator. "Liberty is a slow fruit," Emerson began. He was laying the foundation for an explanation of why it took Lincoln so long to issue his proclamation. It takes a long time for the fruit of liberty to ripen. The public was not yet ready, Emerson explained. The audience for the proclamation had to be created, an audience hitherto passive and unconcerned, quote, now at last so scorched and kindled that they come forward. When the war began, Emerson suggested, public indifference to slavery was so ingrained, hostility to emancipation so deep, that Lincoln had to wait to educate the people up to the justice of the cause before he could act. And so Lincoln waited with infinite patience until the, quote, public sentiment of the country was at last unmistakably pronounced. When we consider the immense opposition to emancipation that Lincoln faced, Emerson declared, quote, one can hardly say the deliberation took too long. Indeed, against all timorous counsels, Lincoln had the courage to seize the moment. This was greatness. And since it's Emerson talking, we might as well call it transcendental greatness. Lincoln was so fair-minded, so patient, and yet so modest that we can only marvel at the, quote, capacity and virtue which divine providence has made an instrument of benefit so vast. As God's chosen instrument, Lincoln really had no choice but to issue his proclamation. He was put here at this time and in this place to do what had to be done. It was his destiny. Lincoln, Emerson wrote, quote, has been permitted to do more for America than any other American man. And just what had Lincoln done? He removed the blot of slavery from our national honor. lifted the heavy load of the national heart. He freed the slaves, but he also redeemed the nation. So we have two competing explanations for the delayed timing of Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, and as I've indicated, both of them were more or less fully formed before the proclamation was issued on January 1, 1863. Greeley's Lincoln was the reluctant emancipator. Emerson's was the great emancipator. Greeley claimed to be speaking for 20 million Northerners who were waiting anxiously for Lincoln to finally issue the proclamation. Emerson's Lincoln was faced with immense popular opposition to emancipation. He waited patiently for public opinion to come around to his own more advanced views. They can't both be right, but they can both be wrong. Both Greeley and Emerson were blinded by the false premise of the question they were asking: what took Lincoln so long? That question assumes that emancipation would not begin until Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. But the fact is that the Lincoln administration had begun formally emancipating slaves more than a year earlier, on August 8, 1861. There was no 20-month delay requiring any explanation. Lincoln was neither reluctant to emancipate slaves, nor was he waiting patiently for public opinion to catch up with him. By the time he issued the Emancipation Proclamation, the Union had been freeing slaves for almost a year and a half, tens of thousands of slaves. So the mythology of the Emancipation Proclamation is doubly misleading. It's not merely that the Greeley and Emerson explanations for Lincoln's timing were wrong. It's that they both assumed there had been no emancipation until Lincoln finally, at long last, proclaimed it. The myth erased the history. All of the emancipations prior to January 1, 1863 have simply disappeared from our historical memory. And until we recover that history, until we understand how and why slaves were emancipated before the Emancipation Proclamation, we can't possibly understand what the proclamation did, or to be more precise, what the proclamation changed. In the mythic account, emancipation begins with Lincoln's long-awaited proclamation. In the historical account, it begins much earlier. In the spring of 1861, 6 weeks before the war began. On May 30th, Lincoln met with his cabinet to discuss the request by General Benjamin Butler at Fortress Monroe in Virginia that he be allowed to withhold runaway slaves from their owners. Three slaves had escaped to Butler's lines asking for asylum, and when their owners showed up demanding that their fugitives be returned, Butler refused. He called the slaves contraband of war. He sent two urgent letters to Washington, one on May 27th, the second on May 28th, asking whether he had done the right thing. The cabinet met to discuss Butler's request 2 days later on May 30th, and when the meeting was over, the War Department telegraphed the general at Fortress Monroe, not only approving his contraband policy, but authorizing Butler to refuse to return any runaway slaves who came within his lines. There's the first move. Barely 6 weeks after Fort Sumter, the Lincoln administration stopped enforcing the Fugitive Slave Clause of the Constitution for any slaves coming within Union lines from a seceded state. But it wasn't emancipation. Butler was authorized to retain the fugitives, but he was not authorized to free them. Only Congress could determine the status of the fugitives, and that's what Congress proceeded very quickly to do. Shortly after the attack on Fort Sumter, President Lincoln called Congress to come back to Washington for an emergency session 5 months ahead of schedule, beginning on July 4, 1861. Less than 3 weeks later, on July 20th, Senator Lyman Trumbull reported a confiscation bill to the floor and immediately attached an amendment that would emancipate any slaves used by the Confederates in support of their rebellion. Trumbull's emancipation amendment became Section 4 of the First Confiscation Act endorsed by nearly every Republican in Congress, and signed into law by President Lincoln on August 6, 1861. Under the terms of the Confiscation Act, emancipation would be a two-step process. First, Congress would declare that masters would Congress decreed that masters would forfeit the services of any slaves used in the rebellion. Then the president would emancipate the forfeited slaves by virtue of his authority as commander-in-chief, thus giving emancipation the requisite military character the Constitution required. And so, on August 8, 1861, 2 days after he signed the bill into law, Lincoln's War Department issued the instructions for implementing it. Rebel masters would forfeit the services of any slaves used in support of the rebellion, and those slaves were, quote, discharged from service permanently, which is to say they were emancipated. But there was more. The House of Representatives House Republicans had endorsed a resolution declaring that Union soldiers were not to participate in any way in the capture and return of fugitive slaves, which meant any slaves coming into Union lines in the South, the Union Army could not return to their owners. Since, in Butler's words, the Union did not want and would not hold such slaves as such fugitives as slaves, the only thing the War Department could do was emancipate all the slaves who came within Union lines from areas in rebellion. The August 8th instructions were sent that day to Fortress Monroe, where there were by then 900 contrabands, all of whom were immediately freed. That was only the beginning. In September, a copy of the August 8th instructions was sent to General John Dix in Maryland, ordering him to emancipate any slaves escaping into his lines from the seceded state of Virginia. In November, the August 8th instructions were given to the commander of the Joint Army-Navy operation established a Union beachhead at Port Royal on the Sea Islands of South Carolina, off South Carolina. And the 9,000 slaves on those islands were immediately emancipated. In December, the Adjutant General of the War Department ordered General Henry Halleck to emancipate any slaves fleeing into the loyal state of Kentucky from the disloyal state of Tennessee. In his first annual message to Congress that same month, December of 1861, President Lincoln noted that under the terms of the first Confiscation Act, quote, numerous slaves had come within our lines and were, quote, thus liberated. Emancipation accelerated over the course of 1862. In February, General Ambrose Burnside captured New Bern, North Carolina, whereupon he freed the slaves. In April, when General David Hunter captured Fort Pulaski and several of the surrounding islands off the coast of Georgia, he freed the slaves, for he too had been given a copy of the August 8th instructions from the War Department. And in June, when General George McClellan led his immense army of the Potomac up the peninsula headed toward Richmond, he followed the same orders. All slaves who came within his lines were emancipated. Loyal masters might someday be compensated, McClellan explained, but their slaves were immediately, permanently emancipated. By the spring of 1862, thousands of slaves all along the southern Atlantic coast, from Hampton Roads, Virginia, to Fernandina, Florida, had been emancipated under the War Department's August 8th instructions implementing the first Confiscation Act. Emancipation began on August 8th, 1861, not January 1st, 1863. And it accelerated dramatically over the 6 months prior to the Emancipation Proclamation. On April 24, 1862, the Union Navy, commanded by David Farragut, broke through the Confederate defenses of the lower Mississippi River, capturing New Orleans and with it the heavily populated slave plantation parishes of southern Louisiana. Transferred from Virginia, our old friend General Benjamin Butler took control of the area, but was not sure whether the tens of thousands of slaves in southern Louisiana met the criteria for emancipation established by the First Confiscation Act or the War Department's August 8th instructions. Unlike the Sea Islands and Fortress Monroe, the Louisiana slaveholders did not all flee from the Union Army, and many of them claimed to have been loyal. Because the slaves of such owners remained on their plantations, it was unclear whether they came within Union lines, as the law required. Were those slaves emancipated? Butler asked his superiors in Washington. Congress answered the question with a second Confiscation Act, which Lincoln signed into law on July 17, 1862. It declared that in Union-occupied areas of the South, areas that were formerly occupied by the Confederates, that is, areas like southern Louisiana, slaves owned by anyone who could not demonstrate, quote, continuous loyalty to the Union were immediately emancipated. Right away, Lincoln sent word to Butler to implement the new rules. Quote, by the act of Congress, Butler began telling his subordinates, they are clearly free. This was the summer of 1862, 6 months before Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. Horace Greeley was publishing pious editorials, wondering why it was taking Lincoln so long to free the slaves, and all the while, Lincoln was ordering the emancipation of thousands of slaves in the lower Mississippi Valley. Further up the Mississippi River, Generals Ulysses Grant and William Tecumseh Sherman were even more reluctant, more hesitant about emancipation than Butler was. At first, they implemented the Second Confiscation Act only to the extent of allowing slaves into their lines and putting them to work for the Union Army, but they did not assume those slaves had been emancipated. Lincoln's preliminary proclamation set them straight. It quoted extensively from the provisions of the Second Confiscation Act that freed all rebel-owned slaves in Union-occupied areas of the South, which encompassed the areas under the control of Generals Grant and Sherman. Within days, the War Department printed 15,000 copies of Lincoln's preliminary proclamation and distributed them through the Army as General Orders Number 109. Grant and Sherman understood. Quote, they are free, Sherman finally admitted in the fall of 1862. Quote, the president declares the Negroes free. Grant agreed. In November, he assigned Chaplain John Eaton to oversee the transition to free labor among the newly emancipated slaves in the areas under his control, the heavily populated plantation districts along the Mississippi River north of Vicksburg. During those same months, In late 1862, the Secretary of War, Edwin M. Stanton, instructed Union generals in Arkansas to emancipate all slaves coming within Union lines. Now let's listen once more to the way political and military officials were talking about slavery in the year before the Emancipation Proclamation. Listen to Lincoln explaining to Congress in late 1861 that numerous slaves were coming into Union lines and were, quote, thus liberated. To Treasury Secretary Salmon P. Chase, replying to a Sea Island planter who asked about the status of his slaves, quote, they are free, Chase told him. To General Sherman, making the same declaration later in 1862, they are free. The president declares the Negroes free. And to General Benjamin Butler, explaining to his officers in Louisiana that, quote, by the act of Congress, they are clearly free. All of these emancipations were initiated by the Lincoln administration, implementing congressional statutes before the Emancipation Proclamation of January 1, 1863. Which brings us back to the question of the hour. What did the Emancipation Proclamation actually do? If the federal government had been freeing slaves for nearly a year and a half, if tens of thousands had already been emancipated, what changed after Lincoln issued the proclamation? Legally, the proclamation implemented the policy adopted by the Republicans in the Second Confiscation Act, making emancipation universal in the seceded states. The Union had been freeing slaves in areas it occupied. Now it would free slaves in all the unoccupied areas of the rebellious states. Section 6 of the law required a presidential proclamation to be fully implemented, and that's what the Emancipation Proclamation did. But how? How could the president effectively emancipate slaves in areas over which the Union Army had no control? He would do so by changing military policy on the ground in two distinct ways, one of them well known, the other almost completely unknown. First, Lincoln's proclamation authorized the systematic enlistment of blacks into the Union Army. Everyone knew that for the slaves to be freed, the Union had to win the war. If the Confederacy succeeded in establishing its independence, slavery would go on forever. Black soldiers would help prevent this. In the struggle to suppress the Southern rebellion, Lincoln said, black troops did double duty. Every slave recruited into the Union Army deprived the Confederacy of his labor and added that same amount of strength to the North. Lincoln concluded that black soldiers were, quote, indispensable to Union victory in the war, which meant they were indispensable to the destruction of slavery. That's one of the reasons it made sense for Lincoln to announce enlistment of black soldiers in the Emancipation Proclamation. But there was another reason as well. Lincoln and the Republicans believed that service in the Union Army ensured that a soldier who had been a slave could never be re-enslaved. Remember Trumbull's warning. Nobody could be absolutely certain that slaves freed during the war were in fact freed forever. But most Northerners were sure that you could never revoke the freedom of a former slave who risked his life for his country by enlisting in the Union Army. Enlistment guaranteed emancipation. This is one of the reasons black enlistments were highest in states that were exempted from the Emancipation Proclamation, states like Tennessee and Kentucky. For slaves in those states, enlistment was the surest path to irreversible freedom during the Civil War. We know a great deal about the history of black soldiers during the Civil War, but we know almost nothing about enticement, the second major policy change instituted by the Emancipation Proclamation. In fact, we know so little about enticement that I'd be willing to wager that hardly anybody in this room, if anybody at all, knows what it means to say that the Emancipation Proclamation lifted the ban on enticement. You might be able to guess, but I'd be surprised if any of you really know unless you read my book. What did it mean to lift the ban on enticement? To answer that question, we have to go back. We have to understand something else about Union emancipation policy before the proclamation. So let's go back one last time to Fortress Monroe and take a closer look at precisely what Lincoln's cabinet authorized General Butler to do on May 30th, 1861. In his telegram to Butler shortly after the cabinet meeting adjourned that day, the Secretary of War instructed the general to keep all contrabands who came within Union lines, but otherwise to leave the peaceful operation of slavery alone. That same distinction was repeated in the August 8th instructions for implementing the First Confiscation Act. Union soldiers were authorized to emancipate slaves coming into their lines, but they were forbidden to entice slaves away from their masters. Over the course of the next year and a half, the Union authorities maintained the same basic distinction. As John Hay, one of Lincoln's secretaries, put it in September of 1862, the government's policy was, quote, not to return to slavery those slaves who fall necessarily into our hands in the course of the war. But Union soldiers were, quote, not to entice them in, nor incite them to rise. On December 17, 1862, 2 weeks before the proclamation, General Grant ordered his superintendent of contrabands to employ, quote, any Negroes who voluntarily come within the lines of the army. But in no case, Grant added, quote, will Negroes be forced into the service of the government or be enticed away from their own homes except when it becomes a military necessity. That was the ban on enticement, the ban that was lifted by the Emancipation Proclamation. John Nicolay, Lincoln's other secretary, explained the new policy on January 2, 1863, the day after the proclamation. Henceforth, Nicolay said, the slave population will be used to suppress the rebellion, quote, as rapidly as it can be brought within Union lines. It is the policy of this government, General in Chief Henry Halleck explained to Grant in March, quote, to withdraw from the enemy as much productive labor as possible. Union troops must never discourage the Negroes from coming under our protection. This is not only bad policy in itself, Halleck explained, quote, but is directly opposed to the policy adopted by the government. The character of the war has changed, Halleck added. The policy now adopted by the government is, quote, to withdraw from the use of the enemy all the slaves you can, end quote. The War Department's Adjutant General Lorenzo Thomas likewise explained the new policy in the spring of 1862, quote, they are to be encouraged to come within your lines. Lorenzo Thomas was one of the most well-known and influential Union officers engaged in the systematic enticement of slaves, but there were others operating in many parts of the Confederacy, and in the end, the Union Army had assigned 237 soldiers to duty as emancipation agents whose sole purpose was to go onto farms and plantations and encourage slaves to leave their owners. James Ayers was one of those agents, and his remarkable diary gives us a vivid account of just how enticement worked on the ground. I'm going to quote extensively from Ayers' diary, but I need to say in advance that although Ayers was a minister and a devoted abolitionist who hated slavery, he was a 19th century man who used 19th century language, much of which is offensive to us. But to censor his words would destroy the effect of his diary. Here's the entry for May 7th, 1864. On that day, Ayers rode onto a plantation 10 miles outside of Huntsville, Alabama, and into a field where 27 slaves were gathering corn. Whose farm is this? Ayers asked. Master Eldridge's, sir. Is that his house yonder? Yes, massa. Is he good to you? No, not mighty good, massa. Is he a Union man or a secessionist? After telling Ayers that their master, quote, swears and cusses at the Yanks terribly, the slaves went back to work, lest their master, quote, flog us if he see us idle and whip us for talking to you. Ayers reassured them. I have come to tell you good news, he said. Father Abraham has declared you all free. You have no master now. You are free, and I have come to tell you. Getting down from his horse, Ayers began to read from a card announcing that, quote, all slaves were made free men by Abraham Lincoln, and urging, quote, able-bodied colored men to come to the nearest Union camp and, quote, fight for the stars and stripes. Ayers made his pitch. The army would pay $10 a month plus food and clothing, quote, and make you free if you will enlist and be soldiers. How many of you boys will turn out? Ayers asked. When do you want us? Want you right now. Oh, massa won't let us go. Never mind, your master, Ayers protested. You have none. Ayers then rode up to the house where he understood that there were more potential recruits, and there he met the Eldridge family, quote, master, missus, and the gals. How do you do, Ayers said. Fine day this is. Yes, Mr. Eldridge answered. What's all this mean? My niggers say you come into the field and set them all free. Is that so? Yes, sir. Well, I would like to know how you got the authority to do so, sir. By the War Department, sir, I get my authority. The very best authority, ain't it? What do you want with my niggers? Eldridge demanded. Your niggers, Ayers replied. You've got no niggers, my dear sir. These are all free men, as you or I am. And these women here that have been your slaves are all free now, as much so as this lady. Eldridge then invited Ayers to leave, but the Union recruiter was hardly finished. Leave, Ayers said. Why, sir, I will leave when I get ready, but I'm going to take your men, or these men, when I go. You may bet your eyes on that. Ayers then drew his revolver and continued his lecture. Mister, one of Eldridge's daughters interrupted, quote, are you going to take Dad's niggers away from him, whether they are willing or not to go? Well, no, ma'am, I ain't, Ayers replied, but I'll tell you what I am going to do. In his experience, Ayers explained, he had found it best to walk off with the young black men a half mile or so and, quote, have a big talk with them to see if he could persuade them to enlist in the Union Army. those he can't coax would be free to go back. Eldridge's daughter next suggested that Ayres allow her father to speak with the men before they walked off, but Ayres thought that was a bad idea. He had his solitary chat with the men, and when he left, he had six black recruits with him. Shortly thereafter, they enlisted in the 15th Tennessee Colored Regiment based in Nashville. So that's how enticement worked, on a small but fascinating scale, but it also worked on a large scale. Beginning in the spring and summer of 1863, as the enticement policy was systematically implemented, we start to see those truly large numbers of contrabands coming into Union lines, particularly in the Western armies. During the Meridian campaign, for example, Sherman's troops were said to be trailing 4,000 or 5,000 contrabands in their wake. He had another 10,000 freed people with him during his famous march to the sea from Atlanta to Savannah, and 7,000 more followed as his troops marched through the Carolinas. This was military emancipation at high tide, the logical conclusion of the policy of enticement implemented by the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1, 1863. But it wasn't enough to destroy slavery. In the year after Lincoln issued his Emancipation Proclamation, it became increasingly clear to the president and congressional Republicans that no matter how aggressively the Union Army enforced military emancipation in the South, it could never physically free more than a fraction of the slaves. Think of James Ayres. He had walked onto a plantation with 27 slaves and walked off with 6 of them. 21 slaves remained, and nobody could be sure when the war ended that they had been legally emancipated, no matter what Lincoln or Ayres told them. Or think of General Sherman. There were 10,000 freed people with him on his march from Atlanta to Savannah. But in 1860, there were 463,000 slaves in Georgia. Lincoln was certain that all the slaves actually freed during the war could never be returned to slavery, but he also came to realize that when the war ended, most slaves would not have been practically freed. Lincoln could not have been surprised by this, for no one had been more skeptical of the Emancipation Proclamation than he had been. On at least 3 occasions in the months before he issued it, Lincoln expressed serious doubts that a presidential proclamation would do any good. "I can't enforce the law in the rebel states as it is," Lincoln would say. "What makes you think I could enforce an emancipation proclamation in those same states? It would be," he said, "like the papal bull against the comet." And yet, on January 1st, 1863, he issued it, and having done so, Lincoln drastically altered Union military policy on the ground in the South, hoping to make it work. But it still wasn't enough to ensure the complete destruction of slavery, and by 1864, Lincoln and the Republicans understood that, which is why they pushed so strongly for a 13th Amendment. The Democrats, by defeating the amendment in the House in June of 1864, just as that year's presidential campaign was gearing up, turned the campaign into a referendum on abolition. Everyone understood that if Lincoln lost, there would be no amendment and the war would end with Northern victory, but without abolition. And when he was reelected in November, Lincoln invested all of the political capital his victory earned him on getting the amendment through Congress. I've always been skeptical of the mythology shrouding the Emancipation Proclamation. Abraham Lincoln did not free all the slaves with the stroke of his pen. He did not wait patiently for public opinion to catch up with his advanced views. He did not bestride his times and lead his benighted people out of the darkness. And he was not the only man in America responsible for the destruction of slavery. But he was the only indispensable man. It is ironic, isn't it, that someone as temperamentally conservative as Abraham Lincoln would end up leading the most revolutionary social upheaval in American history. But as a friend of mine once said to me, conservatives often make the best radicals. They keep their revolutions from sliding off into terror and anarchy. Of course, when I say that Lincoln and the Republicans were revolutionaries, I don't mean that they were socialists or communists or anarchists. They were never going to smash wage labor or redistribute the land, nor had they set out to abolish the various forms of discrimination that flourished in the United States of their day. They did not believe in racial or social or sexual equality as we commonly understand those things in the 21st century. Yet, in their own time and in their own way, Lincoln and the Republicans were genuine radicals, 19th century radicals, exemplars of that impressive wave of bourgeois revolutions that spread across the Atlantic world beginning in 1776. We Americans are so thoroughly the products of those revolutions. We have so completely absorbed their precepts that we no longer appreciate their explosive implications. The Civil War reminds us of their power. Abraham Lincoln believed that all men and women were equally entitled to their basic freedom, that all Americans of whatever color were entitled to the privileges and immunities of citizenship. He thought it was unnatural for one human being to hold property rights in another human being, and that it was immoral for a master to claim the fruits of a slave's labor. And so he hated slavery. In language that was, for him, uncharacteristically harsh, Lincoln declared that he had always hated slavery, hated it for as long as he could remember, hated it, he said, as much as any abolitionist. Here was the driving passion that, for all of his temperamental conservatism, sustained Lincoln and his fellow Republicans through the great liberal revolution we call the Civil War. As in so many revolutions, the radical impulse once unleashed gathered force with each passing month. Lincoln moved with that revolutionary tide, sometimes taking the lead, never looking back. If that didn't make him the great emancipator, it surely made him our greatest president. Thank you. I am